You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we look at a recent drop in the Great Lakes water levels after some years of record highs. Now the U.S. Senate passed a bill yesterday that would put $250 billion into scientific research, development, and technology manufacturing over the next 5 years. It would also target some of that funding to cities between the coasts. The bill passed 68-32, and it has President Biden's support. It's aimed at keeping America's innovation economy competitive with other countries. Okay, mainly with China. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said yesterday that he sees the bill as key to maintaining the country's place on the world stage.
The world is more competitive now than at any time since the end of the Second World War. If we do nothing, our days as the dominant superpower may be ending.
The bill would still have to pass the House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the investments this bill would make? Do you want to see the U.S. government invest more into research and development of new technology? Do you think that's the right role for the federal government, or would you rather see them stay out of it? And what do you think of the idea of some of this money going to boost innovation in places, you know, that aren't the Silicon Valley or Seattle or the big research hubs on the coast? Maybe the Midwest, maybe Wisconsin. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jonathan Gruber is the Ford Professor of Economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and co-author of the book Jump Starting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
What are some of the things in this bill that jump out to you as maybe having a big impact?
Well, I think it's important, Rob, to get a little background, which we lay out in our book, Jumpstarting America, which is not many people know that in the mid-1960s, the U.S. government spent 2% of the entire country's GDP on public science. That's one in every $50. And that led to the entire modern technology economy, from modern medicines to satellites to digital computers. It also, the government at the same time, invested a mass amount in education. So that combination of more skilled workers with more demand for skills led to really the creation of the modern American middle class. Unfortunately, America's gone away from that commitment, and our spending on public R&D is now down to 0.6% of GDP, and we're 12th in the world, or about half the level of China. So that's one problem. The other problem is the innovation that's happening is all happening in a very limited set of places on the coast. 90% of all the jobs in the innovation sectors in the last 13 years have been created in just five cities, all on the coast. So in a situation where we're falling behind technologically and we're splitting apart. So we have both this external threat of other countries passing us on the technological frontier and the internal threat, which we see politically, of a country dividing between the haves on the coast and the have-nots throughout the country. So what this bill tries to do is really address both things. First of all, there's a major new investment in research and development. It's a complicated bill with lots of moving pieces, but if you sort of do the math, at the end of the day, there's something like $100 billion of new R&D, $100 to $150 billion of new R&D investment over 5 years in this bill, which is great. It's not enough. It still moves us only from 12th in the world to something like 8th in the world. So we need more, but it's a step in the right direction. The second thing this bill does is set up an innovative tech hub competition program where the Department of Commerce would have $10 billion to essentially run what Amazon did. Remember when Amazon set up HQ2? They ran a competition. But their competition was what we call a race to the bottom. It was to see which cities could give them the biggest tax breaks. This competition is a race to the top. Is to find 18 places in America, 18 is the number in the current bill, that can be next generation technology hubs and to give them the resources to compete with a Seattle and a Boston. So if this works, if this bill passes and works the way I hope and expect it to, we're going to have a country that innovates more, grows faster, and grows more equally around the country.
One of the objections to this kind of idea, and it came from some of the senators who voted against it, though, again, 68 votes for, hard to pull off in the Senate. But one of the objections is, you know, the federal government isn't great at picking winners, at knowing where we need to invest money to research for the future. Better left to private businesses, to the market, and that's going to lead us to where we need to go. What do you say to that objection?
Well, basically, that's an objection we write about extensively in our book, and I'd urge people to read it. There's really two fundamental failures with relying on the private market for R&D. The first is that private companies aren't interested in the kind of basic innovation that drives economies. They're rightly, I'm a capitalist, they're rightly interested in their own bottom lines. But their own bottom line means doing research that benefits them and not sharing it. So here's a simple example, Rob. Corporate scientists used to be some of the leading scientists in our nation. They'd win Nobel Prizes. You remember the Bell Labs days. Publications by corporate scientists are down 60% in the last three decades. And companies like IBM explicitly no longer reward their scientists for publications, which broaden the knowledge base, but only for patents, which affect only the profits of IBM. So that's the first problem, is companies aren't doing the research on things like the Human Genome Project, okay, on genetic mapping, which benefit all of us. The second problem is that there's what they call the valley of death, which is that new companies can't get the capital to get started. Now, you might think that's funny because everybody knows about the famous U.S. venture capital sector and how good they've been at, you know, financing companies like Apple. But they're good at companies that produce software. They're not very good at companies that produce hardware, where they take large investments, take a long time to pay off. That really needs public commitments. And those are the kind of commitments that are made in this bill.
Talking to Jonathan Gruber from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, co-author of the book Jumpstarting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Looking at this bill just passed the Senate with enough votes to pass it, including Republicans with the Democratic majority, that would make new investments in research and development, technology here in the United States, and try to bring some hubs away from the coast that already have a lot of this kind of stuff. You could join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, let's go to part two here now. This idea, as you were mentioning earlier, of trying to create new hubs where they aren't now. Can the federal government do enough to make that happen, to grow a Silicon Valley outside of the valley?
Well, I think Silicon Valley... We should not grow new Silicon Valley. I don't think anywhere in America can really compete for the kind of IT software innovation that's done in Silicon Valley. But we have lots of other technologies we need. Okay, let me ask a question. I won't wait for an answer, but if any of your listeners get this right, that'd be terrific, because I've asked this question about 3,000 people and only about 20 have gotten it right, which the question is, where is the national hub for developing computer simulation as well as the home of the largest university in America? The answer is Orlando, Florida. Why Orlando, Florida? Because the government put a Navy base in Orlando, Florida as a political favor in the 1960s. The University of Central Florida, which at the time was a very middling university, partnered with the Navy to set up a corporate research park around computer simulation. Today, that research park, the Central Florida Research Park, employs 10,000 people, and East Orange County has added 100,000 people, over 100,000 jobs over 30 years. All off a government investment in a new technology in that city. This can happen all over the country. We document in our book 102 cities where people are well, including many in Wisconsin, where people are well educated, where there are great universities, where there are affordable housing. So we don't have to deal with the fact that basically, yes, there are the superstar cities that no one can afford to move to, because the average house price in a superstar city is three times the average house price in other cities. We need to create affordable new tech hubs, and that's what we suggest in the book.
Okay, if I live in Wisconsin, I might think, okay, great, you get a hub here in the state in one of these cities you're talking about, but I live in a rural area, so what? What is it going to do for me?
Well, 54% of rural Americans actually live within a metro area. We are not talking about a hub that would just literally be a city block. We're talking about a hub that would be an entire economy. If you think about the reach of a Seattle or a Boston, it reaches many, many miles outside the city, okay? And many, many miles outside of places in Wisconsin we talk about in our book, like Janesville, Benoit, and Madison, or Milwaukee, or Appleton, Green Bay, and Oshkosh. These are places where there's rural people living nearby who can benefit. Moreover, even people who are far from these cities, you have to ask yourself, are those people really going to get up and move to San Francisco for a job when they have to be so far from family, when housing's unaffordable? No. Might they move to Madison, where, yes, it may be 3 hours from their family, but at least they can go home for dinner on the weekends and housing's affordable, they might. So we think this benefits not just a small set of cities, but the entire U.S.
We're talking to John Gruber, professor of economics at MIT, author of the book Jumpstarting America, looking at a bill passed yesterday by the U.S. Senate that would invest hundreds of millions of dollars into technology research and development around the country over the next 5 years. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what's in this bill and how the U.S. is doing at developing and making new technology compared to the rest of the world? Do you worry, as the bill's authors say they do, about how we're doing, especially compared to countries like China, who are making bigger proportional investments in this kind of stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Jonathan Gruber, economics professor at MIT, about the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act. It passed the U.S. Senate yesterday. Aims to put more money into research and development of high technology manufacturing, and more, and tries to bring high-tech hubs off of the coast, or in addition to the coast, to other places, maybe here. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea? Do you want to see the federal government making more of these kind of investments? Do you think we need to do it to stay competitive? Or should the federal government stay out of these kind of things, leave it to the market? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. John, we've talked about some of the objections raised by people who don't think that the government should be doing this kind of investment in the first place. The other end is that this isn't enough. $250 billion divided by 5 years, divided by how many projects and focuses and technologies. Is this enough to make a difference, John?
Look, it is enough to make a difference. It's not enough. It shouldn't be. It's a starting point. It's not an ending point. If I had my druthers, I would be doing about on the order of 10 times as much. And that would put us back in the lead of the world. I think at an era when interest rates are basically zero, the government needs to be thinking about making investments in our future, and there's no higher return investment than research and development. So no, I don't think it's enough, but it's the largest increment to R&D spending in a long time. And importantly, if the tech hubs are successful, they can build broader community support to understand the fundamental fact about R&D that scientists do not highlight enough, which is science creates jobs. Okay, this is the thing. We want jobs. We want good jobs. The way to get good jobs is to innovate and create new products. We have to hire people to make them. And the more that happens around our country, the more there'll be broad support for investing in that science. So I think we're not done with this bill, but I think it's a powerful first step.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Eric is with us in Milwaukee. Eric, hi.
Hey there, thanks for having me.
Now, what did you want to bring up, Eric?
Hey, so I work for a large social media company based in San Francisco, but work remotely in Milwaukee. And I just wanted to say that I do think that the federal government should be encouraging large tech-based companies to be expanding to non-coastal, potentially smaller cities. And then the other thing that I guess I'd like to say is that with the pandemic and the advent of more remote-based work, I think it's important for the federal government to set up, and local governments as well, to make cities and locations more appealing for remote workers, and having companies set up hubs, even if they're not large offices, I think is going to be enough to attract some remote workers who don't even work for those companies, so long as there's the name recognition.
Eric, interesting. Thanks for the call. John, what do you think of that model?
Well, I mean, I agree with the general sense. I think it's a great point. You know, our book was written before COVID, and I don't know how much the world has really changed in the long run in the sense of, gee, you could say, well, look, the tech hub's problem's going to go away because no one has to live there anymore. I don't think that's really going to happen. I think people, they may not want to live in downtown Boston, but they're not going to leave Boston. They're still going to be in Boston. And I think at the end of the day, if a place in Wisconsin or where my wife's from in Minnesota, I know there's some competition there, but I just had to mention it. If a place in one of those states wants to really compete, they're going to need to make a big investment, bigger than these cities can afford on their own, and they're going to need federal help.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to John Gruber from MIT, co-author of the book Jump, Starting America, How Breakthrough Science Can Revive Economic Growth and the American Dream. Now, with this bill that passed the Senate, supporters are really talking up competition with China here. That people might think, okay, China, yeah, they've taken a lot of manufacturing from the U.S. and from around the world. We know that. Are they really taking such a lead when it comes to technological innovation, John, maybe based in part on the investments we talked about earlier?
They are. China is taking an enormous lead, and there's nowhere better to see that than the examples we refer to in the last chapter of our book, which is technologies that were invented in the U.S., perfected in the U.S., but then due to lack of government funding didn't flourish in the U.S. and now are dominant in China. Take synthetic biology. This is essentially the recreation of biological processes artificially in the lab, a critical area for future research, especially in the era of pandemics. That was a field invented here at MIT, perfected in the U.S. With funding from the National Science Foundation, but after 10 years, the National Science Foundation cut off the funding. At that point, the field dwindled in the U.S. and took off in China, to the point where the international competition in this area, which the U.S. used to dominate, we now lose annually to China. There's area after area where China has realized the way that they're going to jumpstart their role in the world economy. I mean, they've developed incredibly rapidly, right, relative to any other country in history. And they realize innovation is their way to world leadership. I don't want to say domination. This isn't about fear-mongering. It's economic leadership, and it's about jobs. It's about whether those good, high-value jobs are going to be in the U.S. or China. There is real competition there. And the way to win that competition is not with tariffs on Chinese refrigerators. That doesn't win the competition. That just hurts U.S. consumers. The way to win the competition with China is to out-invent them, and that requires investment.
We heard from Marcus in Madison, who says, so much R&D is a transfer of public money into private hands, from universities to Pentagon contractors. If the public is paying for it, Marcus says, we should get paid back for it and realize the profits. And that's a concern others have raised. If public money is going into it and then a private company ends up making the money, are we kind of getting ripped off?
That's a great question. So two answers to that. One is not always. Let's take the Human Genome Project. This was a project where the National Institutes of Health put in $3 billion over a 13-year period to map the human genome. Directly because of this investment, today we have a genomic sector in America that employs directly or indirectly 270,000 people and pays $6 billion per year in taxes. So that's a 200% return every single year. So that's a case where we weren't getting ripped off or making money. On the other hand, there are lots of cases where that's not true, where we spend a lot of money in NIH to do basic science, and then pharmaceutical companies run with that, develop a drug, and pay no taxes. That's why we need corporate tax reform as well. And that's why, indeed, Biden's proposal, which included R&D, would have funded it with a corporate tax increase. I think that's totally appropriate. In many ways, you can sort of think of we've shifted R&D from corporations used to do it, like Bell Labs, to now the government has to do it, which is fine, but then corporations need to pay their share. So I think the answer is not to try to figure out some way for the government to try to take the patent back, which I think is very dangerous, but basically the corporations to pay their fair share in taxes and for us to get the return that way.
Do we forget the history of American investment in research and development and what we've gotten out of it? I guess I'm thinking mainly of the internet. If you can talk about it, that as an example of something that started in many ways from government projects.
Well, everything in science fundamentally started with government funding. I mean, literally every drug that was invented over the last 15 years is based in some way or form on NIH-sponsored research. The internet was based on basically the Department of Defense wanted to set up a network to communicate around the country, and they invested in the R&D to do so. A great example in our book was a company that basically was hired by the military to develop a new technology to find mines, to find landmines and defuse them. It realized this technology had broader uses, and the Roomba was born. Today, iRobot makes most of their money not from defense contracts, but from the Roomba, and they employ 1,000 people in America making Roombas. Okay, they're basically technology after technology, from the GPS that helps you find your way home, to the drugs that keep you alive, to the airplanes that fly you places, to the computer you use at your desk, it all came fundamentally from public R&D in partnership with the private sector. Okay, I'm not a socialist. I'm not suggesting government takeover. This is all, and, you know, this is all about government partnering with the private sector, not displacing the private sector. And then, of course, it does raise the issue the previous person raised about the fact that how does the government get the return, and that is a challenge. So it's really about partnering with the private sector, but then taxing the private sector to make sure the government shares in the benefits of that partnership.
In just our last minute, John, we've mostly focused on this bill that passed the Senate, which still have to go through the House. The president says he supports it. Is there what would be the best next step, assuming this thing went through? What would be the next priority you'd want to focus on?
Well, there's a lot of implement. You know, I worked very carefully on the Affordable Care Act, and we've seen the problems in rolling that out that we saw. There's a lot of details once you pass a bill and actually implementing it. For example, this tech hub competition, we want to make sure it's a real competition, not just a political boondoggle. That involves careful work by the Commerce Department to set up the competition. We want to make sure these new forms of R&D are spent appropriately. So there's a lot of work that has to go into actually making the money spent appropriately. But I think the next steps would be to just keep going, to set these up, and then to really start to build the drum for an increasing trajectory. China has committed to increasing the share of their GDP they spend in R&D year over year. We need to keep up with that. So this needs to be the beginning of the conversation, not the end.
This will be the end of our conversation, though, John. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. My pleasure.
That's Jonathan Gruber, professor of economics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, co-author of the book Jump Starting America. He talked with us about what the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act would mean for technology research and manufacturing in the country. That bill passed the U.S. Senate, waiting for action now in the House. Coming up, an expert explains why water levels in the Great Lakes dropped this year after some record high levels in the recent past. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee says it won't cooperate with the state on its investigation into abuse by clergy members. We'll look at what the Department of Justice is requesting from church institutions, why the Archdiocese is saying they won't help, and what may happen next. Now, water levels in all the Great Lakes dropped this year. The decrease comes after years of increasing water levels, with Lake Michigan hitting records for 8 months in 2020. Adam Beckley is a coastal engineering outreach specialist at University of Wisconsin Sea Grant. Adam, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Before we get into this latest drop, let's talk about what had been happening, the rising water levels going back a handful of years now. What was that trend looking like?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, all the Great Lakes were extremely high. Lake Erie and Lake Ontario reached record highs, all-time record highs, and Lake Superior came within about an inch of a record high, Lake Michigan about 2 inches of a record high in 2020. And so really a big driver behind that was a very wet climate that we've been having for the last few years. So looking back at the upper Midwest precipitation, we hadn't had a below or average year since 2012. Setting records in 2017 and 2019. So all that water was filling up our Great Lakes. And at the same time, the evaporation that naturally takes water out of the lakes really kind of shut off and was below average for that period as well. So when you combine that water coming in and sort of lack of water leaving, that really made the water levels shoot up to record or near record highs.
What makes evaporation shut down? Does that just mean more average cloud cover, lower temperatures? What's going on with that side of the equation?
Yeah, so evaporation is the really tricky side of this equation. Precipitation, we get a good handle on because, you know, it falls over us. Evaporation happens over the lake. We don't have many observations out there. So that's still kind of something that's actively being researched. There's some thought about there. We had those polar vortex years, which really drove lake temperatures down. So I can't say with 100% certainty, but there was definitely something going on that would cause a pretty stark change.
And now we see the levels tapering off some. I don't think they're dangerously low or anything like that. What is driving that now?
Yeah, so basically once, looking at Lake Michigan, for example, Lake Michigan peaked out, almost hitting that record high last July. And then since then, it's sort of been going down, and we've had our precipitation really shut off, and that really is noticeable this year, as many people have probably noticed in their yards. But looking at the water falling specifically in the Lake Michigan basin, so water that makes it into Lake Michigan, in 2021 so far, we've had about half of the normal precipitation. So really taken one side of that equation out, and the water levels have responded correspondingly.
Now, Adam, I dimly remember doing segments not that long ago in the annals of history on really low levels in the Great Lakes. I don't know, 10, 15 years back. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct. So January of 2013 was when Lake Michigan set an all-time record low. And then pretty much right after that, we started this proceeding to our near record highs. And so going back and looking at what was the cause there, there's a recent study out from the University of Michigan, Drew Grunwald's lab, looking at what was behind that. And so then we had high evaporation from about 1998 to 2013. And then our precipitation was kind of neither high nor low, kind of in between. So really that evaporation was driving those low water levels. And then sort of the switch flipped. We got high precipitation and low evaporation.
So that seems fast to me, to go from record or near record lows to record or near record highs in, you know, just less than a decade. Really, is the story here variability? And is that weird?
Definitely variability is something that we've seen on the Great Lakes since we've set eyes on it. The water levels go up and they go down throughout history. We've seen highs and lows, throughout the historical record and beyond. But this sort of bounce from record lows to basically a record high is the term I've seen used is unprecedented. So,
okay. So do we have thoughts on why this unprecedented swinginess in our lake levels?
I think that's definitely an active area of research. Again, referencing that University of Michigan study, noting that like very quick change in regime from being dominated by evaporation when we had the record lows to that evaporation shutting off, basically, and then record high precipitation. Very dramatic changes in what was causing low water levels and then the perfect conditions to cause high water levels.
How much do we feel this and see this on shorelines, Adam? How much of a deal is this for property owners or public beaches or all the stuff we like to do on the edge of a Great Lake?
Sure. So maybe, one thing that would be really noticeable for folks who maybe have been out on a beach on the Great Lakes in the last few years is lower water levels is typically going to make the beach a little wider. So last year, the year before, a lot of that beach was underwater. Now, as the lake levels have receded a foot, 2 feet, depending on which lake you're on, that beach is sort of uncovered. And so you definitely will see wider beaches. From a property owner's perspective, maybe some relief from erosion. When we have high water levels, it makes it that much easier for waves to reach our properties, bluffs and things like that, and cause erosion. So there'll be a little bit more breathing room between storm waves and things that we care about and don't want to erode or flood.
In our last few moments, Adam, what to you is the biggest open question when it comes to what drives the levels of our Great Lakes?
Well, I think the biggest question that I get a lot and it's hard to answer is what to expect next. And it's quite hard to forecast where Great Lakes water levels are going to go beyond the next few months and then looking many years down the road. So definitely preparing for highs and lows, possibly higher highs and lower lows. But what exactly those are, that's a big question.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Adam Beckley, Coastal Engineering Outreach Specialist at the UW Sea Grant. He joined us for a look at water levels in the Great Lakes. They were at record or near record highs very recently, dipping some now. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on a program that hopes to promote healing through poetry and sharing stories. As a note, this story discusses sexual assault and human trafficking.
Human trafficking is a reality across Wisconsin. It impacts urban and rural communities. It involves young people and older ones, men and women. The legal difficulties that survivors of trafficking face can be substantial, and the trauma they've experienced can be immense. The new podcast, Human Powered, from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities, is exploring this issue in one of its episodes. Here's producer Jade Isery-Ramos.
There's a legal clinic in Wisconsin that works with survivors of human trafficking and sexual assault. It's called LOTUS.
The demand for our services is tragic, heartbreaking, constant, and growing.
That's Rachel Monica Wilcox, the founder of LOTUS. Her team provides legal support for their clients, but they also invest in survivors and really help them share their stories, if they choose to.
For me, it's really nurturing to be able to help forge a path for somebody who's coming up, because I have walked this walk. There's a reason I'm a trail runner. You know, it's my destiny to break a path. And then I feel strongly whenever I just sit down with somebody, start talking, and I say, oh, I know where you are. I've been there. Try and look at it this way. This is what happened for me, and maybe that will help you.
It started off as a pretty straightforward legal clinic, and Rachel was connecting with survivors, finding lawyers, chasing down grants. But all this work she was putting in didn't just help others. It also gave her a way to integrate her own healing with the work.
LOTUS is the answer to an unmet desire in my heart for how I could have been helped. I truly struggled with deep depression, with anxiety, with suicidal behavior throughout my teenage years. And a lot of that was just the result of early childhood trauma. I was sexually assaulted when I was 7. But no one really knew the real story, because you only start to manifest what's wrong with you, and then people start attacking your symptoms. But nobody ever really asked me, what happened to you?
Back at LOTUS, Rachel started making space to have conversations, to tell the untold stories. Actually, that became the name of the new project at LOTUS, Untold Stories. It's a writing and art-making workshop for survivors of trafficking and gender-based violence.
When you can bring those 15 people together in that room, and within an hour, everyone is crying and laughing and loving on each other, because you don't have to explain. There is a bond. It's undeniable.
Sitting in that room in that kind of a circle with people who've been through similar experiences, and hearing them speak candidly, clearly, with empathy, and with incredible creativity and imagination, was very inspiring.
For the last 2 years, the Untold Stories workshop has been led by Austin Reese, who first came to Untold Stories as a participant.
You have these negative feelings, these very hard, painful emotions and memories, but you take them and you transform them into a positive, into a small creation, if you will, a poem.
So the group reads poems, they talk about poems, and then they write their own and share them. Slowly, everyone finds their voice.
There's something implicit about poetry where it has an audience. It's meant to be spoken, it's meant to be heard, it's meant to move somebody in what I would call a brief, intense agreement of feeling. And these moments are rare in life, but I think the gift of a poem is that when you put it out there to be heard, there is this sense of genuine connection and empathy.
The writing workshop brings out different things in people. Where I see it ending at the end of the day is that it gives people a powerful tool for finding their own voice to identify themselves and get their feet firmly planted in the honesty of who they are. Know your truth. Know your truth. And then if they choose, speak your truth.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we'll look at some of the legal issues involved with the state's investigation of clergy abuse in Wisconsin's Catholic institutions. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, the first new treatment for Alzheimer's disease in nearly 20 years has been approved by the FDA. Jen White asked what this might mean for the millions of Americans impacted by Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the Catholic Church in Milwaukee is telling the state its new investigation into abuse by clergy members is over the top. Back in April, Attorney General Josh Call announced the DOJ would be looking into allegations of Wisconsin's five dioceses and its religious orders. It's also planning on taking direct reports from survivors, families, friends, and victim advocates. The Archdiocese of Milwaukee says the request is unreasonable. For one thing, they say they don't have the resources to comply. They say the state lacks the authority to conduct the investigation and that they're being unfairly targeted. In a statement, Call said he's disappointed with the church's lack of cooperation, but the investigation will proceed. Howard Schwaber is an associate professor of political science and legal studies at UW-Madison. He's an expert in constitutional law, free speech, and American politics. Howard, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me.
We've seen this happen in other states, Howard, these statewide investigations, often on top of earlier, maybe more local investigations. What was your reaction to this happening here in Wisconsin?
Well, I was not at all surprised that the state took this action. At the moment, right now, there are 21 other states that have ongoing investigations similar to this one. And in every single case, this takes place against the backdrop of a prior settlement by the church in various forms and in various amounts. Right. So in all of these cases, you have previously settled claims, but you also have new claims coming out or new information being unearthed or alleged, and a background of a general perception that there's a lot more, you know, the tip of the iceberg, so to speak. Just this past week in Canada, the discovery of 250 graves at a school that had been run by the church. These were deaths that occurred decades ago. But I think there's a general sense that there's a lot more left to uncover, and a lot of states, not just Wisconsin, are seeking to find out what else is out there.
Now, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee says these cases, some of which go back decades, have already been investigated by legal authorities. The church has made changes, they say, to prevent these things happening again. What do you think of that argument that at this point a statewide investigation is redundant?
Right. So that's one of, as I read it, and I read through the documents, the diocese makes four separate arguments, and that's one of them. That argument really has two parts. One part, so the diocese has said it will not cooperate with any investigation of past events, but it will cooperate with any investigation of allegations of present or future events. So the diocese is trying to draw a sharp line and say, look, the past is the past, move beyond it, but we are good actors. We have tried to reform our procedures, and more than that, we will cooperate in dealing with any future allegations. Part of the background here is that just last year, a Wisconsin man committed suicide and in his note claimed that he had been the victim of clergy abuse that had not been covered by the settlement, which took place in 2015. And so there are sort of two problems, at least from my perspective, from a legal perspective, with the diocese's position. One is there's this presumption that there are no more past cases to be discovered, that all of them were discovered and dealt with, which as a factual matter seems somewhat questionable. And the other is that even if damages have been paid, you know, that there's nothing left to do, no investigation, no healing, no further disclosure of information, you know, that could be of benefit in which the state might have a legitimate interest. And both of those strike me as problematic positions.
And we have the Attorney General. You mentioned a closure for victims. The Attorney General appeared with victims and members and leaders of victims' organizations. How important do you think it is to try to dig into these stories, as the Attorney General says anyway, to benefit those victims?
Well, I think that's a question for the victims, the Attorney General. You know, that's not a legal question. It's a policy and philosophical question. I do want to focus on two of the arguments the diocese made, though, which I think are particularly interesting. One is the claim that is the argument that all claims should have been filed during the diocese bankruptcy proceedings. And that's basically a not very coded way of saying, look, we're not going to have money to pay any damages. We liquidated all outstanding claims during bankruptcy. If you try to raise a new claim now, we're going to say it was barred. You should have brought it up then. And so even if past events are discovered by this investigation, right? One argument is there are no undiscovered events, but the other argument is even if such undiscovered events should turn up, we shouldn't be liable to pay any damages. And that's a pretty That's a bit of a reach. The other one, though, that's really much more interesting is the assertion of bias. The Archdiocese is asserting that there's evidence of anti-Catholic bias in the way that the state has conducted itself and in some training materials. What makes that argument so interesting is that it goes to a recent Supreme Court case that a lot of your listeners probably know called Masterpiece Cake Shop. That was a case about the baker in Colorado who didn't want to sell a wedding cake to a same-sex couple, and he was effectively busted by the Anti-Discrimination Commission for violation of the Colorado law. And the Supreme Court, in an opinion by Kennedy, said something really interesting. They said, we're sending this back. You've got to redo it because the way you did it was wrong. And what was wrong was that a member of the commission that reviewed the case had made expressed anti-religious sentiments. And so it's this idea, it was a brand new theory, we've never heard of before, that you have a constitutional right to only deal with state actors who are friendly toward your beliefs. That even if there's no effect on the outcome, the mere fact that there might be subjective bias on the part of government officials is enough to invalidate a state proceeding. This was a brand new theory that has never existed before, and it seems to be that the diocese is relying on that theory and are going to try and to invalidate this investigation, not by showing, I can't emphasize this enough, it's not a claim that there's a bias that affected the outcome, because that, of course, would be a constitutional violation. But the mere fact that they're able to assert there's bias on the part of some government official, just subjectively, should be enough to invalidate the state's actions. And that actually seems to be the argument on which the diocese is putting the most weight. And as I say, it's a rather radical First Amendment theory, but it's a theory to which the Supreme Court opened the door in Masterpiece Cake Shop.
All right, so now if we've got a State Department of Justice that says, hey, religious institution, we want access to people to talk to them, we want access to your records, especially to go back in time, and one unit, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee in this case, says, no, we're not going to cooperate, what next? What happens?
Well, so, you know, let's go back again to another basic constitutional principle. This is not a new one. It goes back a long way. There is no religious right to be exempted from the operation of ordinary law. Religious belief or being a religious institution does mean you have certain special, of course, protections as a matter of free exercise, but there's no exemption from law generally. So the church, no more than any other party, can simply say we refuse to cooperate in a proper criminal investigation. So what will happen is all of these claims that we've just been discussing will have to be adjudicated. And if at the end of the day, at the end of those arguments, a court says, nope, this is a valid investigation being carried out in a valid way, then they will have to comply or face contempt charges and fines. But this is in part a delaying tactic. That is, all of these legal questions we've just gone through will have to be gone through by a court, adjudicated by a court, before Wisconsin ever gets to the point of being able to enforce its demand for records and information.
So what happens next? What are you watching for?
I presume that this will go to a court. Probably, given the nature of the investigation, the events, there isn't sort of immediate urgency. So probably there will not be some sort of expedited thing. This will go through the usual stages, the district court, court of appeals. It could easily reach the state Supreme Court. And the question will be, the questions will be, you know, can the diocese say, look, we've taken steps, therefore there's no legitimate state purpose in investigating any further past acts? Can they say, even if there were such a legitimate interest, we can't possibly be required to pay any damages, so there's no good reason for this? And can they say, look, we have reason to believe that someone involved in this harbors an anti-Catholic bias, and therefore that invalidates anything the state does, regardless of showing that that bias had any effect on any state conduct? If they win one of those arguments, that would put Wisconsin back to square one, to having to start over. With a new investigation under new premises. It bears repeating. The diocese is not refusing to cooperate in investigations into present and future conduct. This is an attempt to close the door on everything that's happened in the past. But of course, for survivors groups, for victims' relatives, and as a matter of public policy, there's a very powerful legitimate state interest in discovering what happened in the past. Closure is only one of the reasons to want to know that information. And so I think, you know, it will be interesting to see how this play out. The diocese is taking a pretty radical legal stance. As I mentioned, 21 other states are going ahead with these investigations. But the Wisconsin courts have been sympathetic to these kind of very conservative, very pro-religious arguments in the past. And it will be obviously interesting to see how the arguments are worked out in this case.
Howard, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
That's Howard Schwaber, Associate Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies at UW-Madison. We talked to him about the state's investigation of clergy abuse in Catholic institutions around the state and the response from the Milwaukee Archdiocese. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll look at the findings of a bipartisan Senate report on security lapses in the run-up to the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. That and more as part of our weekly look at some of the top stories in national news. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.